Welcome, everyone, to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and we are joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I am fine, thanks. And yourself, Nick?
I'm pretty good, considering how cold it is. And Sarah, how are you this morning? Sarah Gone.
You stole the words right out of my mouth. I'm getting colder by the day.
Hopefully it should warm up from tomorrow, so we will not be stuck whinging about the weather, which is, I think, something we do every winter when there's a cold front. Right, let's start off with, Sarah, you said us in our pre-show discussion, we've got another sort of series of Groundhog Day stories, where it just the same thing happens over and over again. And this is that a state-run media company in China, of course, all media companies in China are at least state-influenced,
state-run, has written
a article calling for retaliation against the United Kingdom after the UK announced that it would, by 2023, seek to strip all Huawei tech from its telecommunications network and its government facilities, basically. This Chinese editorial called for revenge against the United Kingdom and that it should be public and painful. Now, we had a story last week about China's saber rattling. Sarah, is this getting worse, do you think?
I don't know if this will be consoling, but I think this is actually a sign of the Chinese being a bit rattled by the fact that the West has not welcomed its illiberal activities of late with awe and fascination. Because if you're really on top of things, why should you comment? I mean, it should be beneath you. You China, you the great the great ex-civilization or current civilization. So I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I have to say there's something intriguing about the idea of the nature of the revenge that must be enacted. I think it opens up to all sorts of possibilities. Although you might argue that the Chinese have already wreaked their revenge on the entire world through COVID, but maybe I'm being a little simplistic about it.
Herman, you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I must say when I first heard the phrase that, public and painful, I thought, oh my word, China is going to influence the next British election to elect a Corbyn government. and I just thought, yep, that would be public and it would be painful. But I think Sarah is absolutely spot on. If you have to make threats, then that does say something about the position you're in and the strength and the capacity you might have. A strength is a threat is really a very strange thing for a very, very strong nation to make, especially during this time. But I genuinely try to wrap my head around what's going on in the world, and it's insane, actually, to think what is actually going on currently. We have the culture wars in America. We have COVID, and we have this will they, won't they return of capitalist liberalism in the UK. No one knows actually what's going on in Germany, and France is heading into an election that might see Macron lose. Then on the other side of the world, we have China engaging in small military confrontations with India. And now out of nowhere, well, not completely out of nowhere, but now this threat. And it comes, I think, within the context of three things that we must see together: Hong Kong, COVID-19, and Huawei. These three things, I think, are a cocktail of concern to I don't know if we can say Chinese dominance, but certainly Chinese geopolitical and geoeconomic standing and influence.
Sarah?
It's really quite funny because I remember when the bigger debate on Huawei arose in America and England, and Huawei spent a lot of time trying to explain that it was an independent company and purely essentially a capitalist gem. Now, this shows, of course, that it isn't, because it wouldn't be the British government's business whether, I don't know, Uzbekistan stopped importing Marmite. But and it wouldn't be America wouldn't have a response if some country stopped buying Apple Max. But for China, it's an affront against them, which of course means that China is an authoritarian country and that its capitalism is purely that and nothing else. There is no liberalism or democracy on the horizon.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, actually, is that Huawei often tries to defend itself by saying, well, look, we're not actually a state-owned company, and therefore we, these kind of fears being whipped up about us are not really true. But of course, there is no such thing as a not really state-owned company in China, because even if you're not technically owned on paper by the Chinese state, the Chinese state has large powers that it can use to basically take anything it wants from a company. So, for example, if you were Huawei and you were collecting data, at some point in the sort of command structure, the Chinese state would be able to simply requisition anything that you store there, and ultimately direct the company's activities. I'm not sure if Huawei has this, but I know that there are many Chinese companies that, in their sort of founding document, they have to swear allegiance to the Communist Party. So they're not necessarily directly controlled by it, but they have to still swear allegiance to it, which kind of shows you where things are. Herman?
Yeah, no, I think it really is like telling someone, you should not be in this relationship. That person has anger issues. And then when the person says, all right, yeah, I'm leaving this relationship, the person alleged to have anger issues just, throws a beehive at a chicken and shouts in German. And then you just go, yes, well, it's a bit of an I told you so, isn't it?
Yes. So Herman, my question to you is this. What we've seen over the past couple of weeks, before COVID happened, the narrative of China was just one that pretty much most people agreed on, which is that it is this rising power. Its economy is growing. It's got a huge population. It's technologically advancing all the time. Its military is getting stronger. Its ability to project influence and power around the world is increasing with the Belt and Road strategy. And it's inevitably, or at least it's inevitably going to challenge the United States and very might possibly dethrone it from its position atop the world. And yet, since COVID happened, we've seen a very sort of marked change in China's attitude. It's become more aggressive. It's had this fight with India in the mountains of the Himalayas. Its military ships have rammed Vietnamese fishing vessels in the South China Sea. It's threatened to invade Taiwan in more aggressive terms than I think it has for many years again. And so there's a theory now kind of that I'm seeing being kicked about in global media, which is that this is actually a sign that China has peaked. Its population is aging at an unprecedented rate. I think it's currently one of the fastest aging populations in the world. Its birth rate is crashing. Its economy may have slowed significantly since COVID has come about. Some of its major export markets are Europe, which is currently in a huge economic flat line or even recession, which means that it's going to have fewer people to sell stuff to. Its other big market is America, which is now starting to take a more hostile attitude towards it. And a lot of its goodwill attitude has fallen apart. Its goodwill attitudes to it around the world have kind of fallen apart because a lot of countries and people blame China for the outbreak of COVID. So, Herman, my question to you is this. Is there something in this China's peak narrative, or is China's rise still very much on the cards?
Well, that's like asking, does God exist? Answer in three words. It's a very, very complex thing. But I must say, my instinctive reading of the situation, and I will go into why shortly. My instinctive reading of the situation is that China's rise was never like the empire rise of either Roman Empire or the British Empire, or more recently, the rise of the United States as, not perhaps an empire, but a dominating geopolitical force. I think that was never sustainable. And I think this might, I mean, this might be, you know, very personal bias, and I don't think I'm wrong, but it is a very subjective judgment, is that the reason it was, that it was, if China, the rise of China was always going to end in tears and kind of almost an economic bubble type occurrence, even if it's over a longer time period, is the success it had, especially since the 80s, in establishing itself as a dominant, or not a dominant, but an increasingly important and more recently dominant geoeconomic force. That success wasn't intrinsically connected to its ideological and its ethical foundation. Mm. Now, what I mean by that is, if you look at Rome, the British Empire, the USA, the successes they achieved had a sort of internal coherence, and it had this idea that it could drive its own momentum. The success China has achieved was abhorrent from its core ideology. The increasingly capitalist economic models and zones that, together with India, saw the massive upliftment of people out of poverty in the last two decades of the 20th century, really wasn't in line with the broad ethics of the Chinese government. So I think there was an inherent weakness that the power, the prestige, the status it achieved was not connected to its core fundamental objective, and that weakens it. That means that you, at some point, you start believing the hype that either some things have gone wrong and you need to go back to your founding values, or things are going so right, it is because of our identity. There's a judgment error that I think happens. So that's the one reason. And then the second, perhaps even more personal reason, is philosophically, I think there is something to be said for the Judeo-Christian ethic. Mm. And I think the fact that you have, it's a country like China with a lack of that Judeo-Christian ethic, that liberal, individual, pro-liberty ethic, I think always made it, an impressive looking house of cards, but a house of cards.
Well, ultimately, time will tell. I honestly hope that you're right, Homan, because I think that as our CEO, Franz Cronier, has suggested, China's rise does actually pose a challenge to a lot of liberal thought, because so many people have been lifted out of poverty in that country. And if it turns out that China's model is sustainable, then I fear for the health of the liberal world order going forward. But let's move on from this weighty topic to another foreign story. And this is the resignation of I believe she was a writer and an editor of the New York Times. The New York Times is, of course, it's referred to sometimes as the paper of record. It's one of the most influential newspapers in the world. But it's recently been riven by a lot of internal conflicts, and we've talked about them, I think, before on the show. But it seems to have come to a head now when one of its newer hires, who is quite well known in the United States, a woman called Barry Weiss, has resigned very publicly from the newspaper, where she described an internal culture of sort of bullying, harassment, nastiness, and the crushing of views that went against sort of woke identity politics and critical race theory adherence, and that she was often privately told by editors to take actions or brave public stances only to be abandoned by them or have her work edited out when she actually published it. And her final, or one of her lines in her resignation letter, which is very stinging, was this. It said that Twitter may not appear on the masthead of the New York Times, but it is its ultimate editor. Yeah. Sarah, is the New York Times done for as the paper of record?
It's probably not yet done for, but from being an incredibly esteemed, probably the best-selling newspaper in the world, it is, its reputation will certainly be sullied amongst the the center and the right, because it's gone increasingly left over the years anyway. But the level of intolerance that is being displayed is straight out of the sort of culture wars playbook, because the intolerance is being expressed by young people in the organization. And Barry Weiss herself is only 35 years old. But she is being essentially maligned by groups of people who are way less experienced and probably considerably younger than her. In other words, they're young and they don't know very much at this stage, but they do know that they are self-righteous and they are the purveyors of all that is right at the New York Times, even though they've only been there for 10 minutes. And what's really, really worrying is one editor was forced to resign simply because he allowed a conservative senator to write an op-ed. And now, you know, the sort of pressure on someone like Barry Weiss, who's I think what they call in America a liberal, which is sort of much more left than we would use the term. But she's smart, she's articulate. She has a very high public profile. You'll see on quite a few podcasts and lecture forums, etc. So she's not an insignificant name. And with her going, that really brings attention to what is really happening at the New York Times. And it suggests that the sort of left, the editorship, the management, the left is just succumbing to the cruddy little mob, you know, sitting on the sort of third floor. And that's I would like to hope it's not good for the New York Times, because a paper like that needs to have been either shaken up or shaken down in circumstances like this. It doesn't deserve to continue to be a force, which I think it's already not quite the force it was a few years ago.
Herman?
I think Sara is very much on point, and what she says reminds me of what our great colleague Michael Morris, our IRR head of media, says, who himself spent many years as a journalist, where he makes the point that the younger generation of incoming journalists often have a very different idea of what journalism actually entails, where the older, you know, the people like Michael himself kind of still has the proud legacy of journalism, the Edward R. Murrow journalism of interrogating facts, interrogating people, not creating the narrative, but perhaps discovering the narrative. I think that idea of journalism is becoming almost facilic in its position within the industry, because it's these younger people. They are our peers, Nick. They are perhaps, you know, 5 or so years older than we are, but it's in the same peer group. And if you think of the cultural milieu in which we grew up, where journalism really for our generation became an activist occupation rather than an investigative or fact-finding yes. operation or occupation, that difference is, I think, pronounced. And I think that also goes to the point that the editor who had to resign, or the sub-editor who had to resign over the I think it was what Senator Cotton writing
yes.
an op-ed. It was disservice to the narrative. And that is sinful. It was not proper journalism, according to this new activist narrative driving interpretation of journalism, where our older colleagues, or the older journalists like our colleague Michael, is really discovering the narrative, seeking the narrative, finding the narrative in societal events like good. We can almost call them contemporary historians, where current journalism of the new sort is along the lines of creating the narrative. And just to close off this point, I think there's a phrase that really just grinds my gears that I hear in discussion programs across the world as a young person. If I hear a vulnerable person saying, as a young person, I will abide by immigration law, I will become a resident or a citizen, I will find you, I will punch you in the face. It is a denial of the best concept of logical reasoning, of thinking that through proper contemplation, thought, fact-finding, consideration, you can actually think of what life must be like for someone not in your exact shoes. It's, you don't have to be precisely there. You don't have to be have to have the full emotive and, you know, anecdotal connotations and understanding. But through reason, you have enough cognitive ability to look at aspects of life where you don't have to say such nonsense as a young person. And I think as a young personism is really strong in the journalistic sphere. And I think it goes to this whole idea of, you know, the embrace of the left was so wide that it is now embracing itself, but the embrace was also so tight that it is now strangling itself.
And just to clarify, Herman, that was a metaphorical punch in the face, no doubt.
No,
he's meant what he said.
Anyway, Sarah, you have something to add to this.
Can I then refer to, because I think it would be pretty much in my generation, is Michael Morrison. I know that Jeremy Gordon has said it before. The problem with this generation of young people is that the way you cut your teeth in journalism in the old days was you were given the court beat. So you had to sit for hours in magistrates' courts, in Supreme Court, waiting for something interesting to happen and trying to understand it. And it refined a whole lot of skills that I think just aren't being refined anymore.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me just to end with a slight, I guess you could call it a hopeful note. It depends kind of how you read it. But this is not actually the first time that the New York Times, which is quite an old newspaper, has, shall we say, had a difficult time. In fact, you could say that this was much worse than it is currently. So it had a journalist called Walter Duranty, who in the 30s mm-hmm. was its correspondent in Moscow. And he actually won a Pulitzer Prize, not unlike current journalists working for the New York Times who may have won Pulitzer Prizes. And a lot of people have questioned the awarding of this Pulitzer Prize because what a lot of his reporting amounted to was, in fact, a defense of Stalin's collectivization policies of the farms, and gave us some very, shall we say, infamous phrases. So here are some things that he wrote between 1931 and 1933 during the height of some of Stalin's greatest crimes. These are the quotes. There is no famine or actual starvation, nor is there likely to be. Any report of a famine in Russia today is an exaggeration or malignant propaganda. Enemies and foreign critics can say what they please. Weaklings and despondents at home may groan under the burden, but the youth and strength of the Russian people is essentially at one with the Kremlin's program, believes it is worthwhile and supports it, however hard be the sledding. And finally, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, which he wrote in defense of Stalin. So if the New York Times could recover from having such odious thoughts expressed in its in its reporting, not just in its opinion pages, really, then I think that it can probably ultimately recover from some of the much, not nearly as terrible malaises that it currently suffers from. Imagine, sorry, final thoughts.
Imagine sitting in you know, a board meeting of the New York Times, and that's the silver lining, where you go, you know, guys, it's not great, but we haven't actively endorsed Assad, and we haven't actively endorsed African warlordship. So, you know, I mean, silver lining, guys.
Sorry.
I just had this vision of exactly that period of saying these appalling things while 6 million Ukrainians are dying of starvation. Now they have, of course, the much less sort of impressive, but sort of equally nasty 1619 project, which was, as I recall, is the New York Times project on how the United States really became a country
in order to defend slavery.
Yeah.
And it has won a Pulitzer Prize, despite the fact that it was forced to do major revisions on the project because of historical inaccuracies that were called out by historians.
History repeats itself.
Well, at least this time it's not quite as bad yet. But there's still a long way to go. Right, so let's go to our final story, which is another sort of Groundhog Day story, which is that our finance minister, Tito Mboweni, probably one of the few actual reformers in government at a senior position, has written an op-ed where he says that we can't really spend our way out of low growth. Herman, do you think he's likely to get anywhere with this op-ed?
No.
My response was going to be, and I quote from that great sage, "No shit, Sherlock."
That's very Eurocentric and Western-centric of you to refer to, a detective I'm not aware of solved a single black murder. So, I mean, Sara, check yourself. You call him a reformer. I wouldn't call him a reformer. I would, there's this, let me quickly, why do I have anecdotes that I believe are really useful to make my points? It's very quick. There was a mobster, let's say Italy somewhere. He had a brother and the brother died. And the surviving brother went to the priest and he said, "Father, you will, during the funeral mass or during the service, you will call my brother a good man. And if you don't, I will kill you." And at the funeral, the priest stood up and he said, "The man we bury today was a murderer, a philanderer, a drug smuggler, a thief, a briber, a fraudster. He was an awful, awful, awful man. But compared to his brother, he was a good man." And I think that's the kind of reformer thing is, compared to the rest of cabinet, Tito Mboweni is a reformer. But ultimately, I think he's not a reformer. I think he's just, a voice of relative reason. And the useful thing he does say is, it is something quite impressive. I think almost historically unique to have in a leftist ethno-nationalist state movement like the ANC and the Tripartite Alliance, to have a finance minister warn of a coming sovereign debt crisis and to explain what a sovereign debt crisis is in a session of parliament. So that's historically quite an interesting place for Tito Mboweni to be. And I just want to read this quote that is actually, it could have been lifted straight from IRR stuff. "The belief that we can spend our way out of low growth is inconsistent with the best available empirical evidence and ignores South Africa's recent poor performance in using government spending as a tool to unlock much needed economic growth." That's Tito Mboweni. That is, it is such sensible writing that I'm sure it would need to be translated for most cabinet members into a language they understand. And it's very, very, very close to what the IRR said in response to the June 24th emergency budget. Now, the question is, does this mean much? I would like to be positive. I can't be, because if your finance minister is talking sense, but your president isn't backing them up, then they are really just a voice calling in the wilderness. And this is almost the reverse situation of, or not the reverse, but perhaps something of an inverse of the Mbeki Manuel relationship, where Manuel came under severe criticism, but Mbeki backed him to the hilt. Mm-hmm. And we have seen nothing similar from Ramaphosa. So that kind of puts a rain cloud over my hope parade.
I suspect that in order to get ANC MPs to take this on board, you'd have to sprinkle in a lot of more references to Marx and Engels before they would take it seriously. Sarah, your thoughts on this?
I'll tell you, I mean, Herman's absolutely right. I mean, Mboweni's the best of a bad bunch, and he's not terrible, but if to say that he's the best of the bad bunch says more about the bunch than anything else. What's also worrying is I think it's around about a year ago that he put forward his sort of structural economic change document as drafted by the Treasury.
Yeah.
And a year later, we've got this new document, economics document from the ANC, I think drafted by Enoch Godongwana, that is probably close to the polar opposite. So I think we can fairly safely assume that the two camps in the ANC, the one may be motivated by ideology, the other one may be motivated by money, but the direction they both agree on, NDR, if that works for all of them, that's the way we're going. And Cyril Ramaphosa follows the majority, and I think he's, he doesn't have to worry about upsetting both factions, because essentially by not inter alia supporting Mboweni, he's going with them down the NDR road, and not involuntarily, but they've actually all got the same goal, and poor old Mboweni is sort of hanging out there trying to express some the sort of sanity that's reflected in the rest of the world, but to not much avail.
Yes. We can only hope that at some point sanity prevails, at least before we have to pay for the consequences of insanity. But on that note, I would like to end with some happier news, which is that the Moderna Inc. vaccine, which I believe is being created by the American National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has been tested on 45 healthy volunteers. And after getting a second booster shot, the people who received the vaccine showed actually higher levels of virus-killing antibodies than people who had been infected with COVID-19. And so now there's some real hope. It's one of the first good signs from a vaccine trial that shows that we may be closer to a vaccine than we think. The other crucial thing was that there were very few side effects with this vaccination. There were some minor, I think, flu-like symptoms, but not too bad. And so they think that it's probably safe to roll out. Sorry, you have something to add?
No, I was just laughing at the idea of minor side effects until the death toll hits the 45 next week. It strikes me as a rather small sample.
Yes, I'll get into that in a second. Herman, you have something to add?
Yeah, no, I think, the risk we run in these podcasts is if you tell it like it is, and it is pretty depressing, you tell it pretty depressing. So, but the one thing that I think we must constantly add, the Institute has been at this for 90 years, and if there's one thing that we can honestly tell people, it is that it is during times of crisis that the best chance to make positive change is tangible. So while we are very down in the dumps and, about the news that we analyze and all that, never forget that this is exactly the time when sober thinking, but solution-orientated thinking is necessary. And I think the vaccine kind of links to that. It's such a beautiful manifestation of the ability to, amidst crisis, while all men about you are losing their heads, is just to say, there's a solution. There is a solution. We need to get to that. And let's
very well said. Very well said, Herman. I completely agree with that. And as to Sarah's point of this being a small sample size, they are now, I believe, looking to roll the vaccine out to 30,000 people. Now that they've seen that it doesn't appear to have major side effects, they're going to roll it out to a much wider spread testing. And one of the interesting stories about this, which we can perhaps talk about at a later date when there's more vaccine news to share, is that a lot of the good things that happened here happened because needless red tape was cut. A lot of, medications, things like vaccines, can take literally years or even decades to go through all of the red tape and the multiple testing and things that on paper seem kind of to maybe make things a bit safer, but ultimately they can cause a lot of harm by preventing care getting to people who need it. And so I think that the medical industry after COVID is over should really take a look at what regulations it really needs, because sometimes they do a lot more harm than they do good. Sari, your final thoughts?
No, I was just thinking, it's amazing how much red tape you can cut when the global economy is at stake.
Yes, that's a good point. All right. Well, on that note, we shall end. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Thank you for sticking with us. And thank you to all the friends at the Institute for the small monthly donations that you give to us to keep supporting our work, our activism, our policy research, and our fight for life, liberty, property, all the good things in South Africa. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll catch you on the Friday edition of the Daily Fringe Show.